So we have a lot of questions so far that have come through this iPad. I don't know if there's any other questions from the audience, but I'll start off asking a few. So this is for Dr. Teitelbaum. How do you increase sodium on a patient with chronically low sodium?
So that is a difficult issue. The way one could physiologically increase sodium would be to use more of the extremely hypertonic solutions, the 4.25% dextrose, and that by the phenomenon that has been called sodium sipping basically pulls more free water and leaves behind sodium. You would increase the serum sodium. The obvious downside to that is the effects of hypertonic or exceedingly hypertonic glucose on the peritoneal membrane. So the single most important thing is to convince patients to drink less to the extent that you might be able to use an increase in a loop diuretic. That too should be able to cause a modest increase in the serum sodium.
Great, thank you. So there's a similar question on what are the options for magnesium replacement in PD patients. And the second question related to the first one would be, they're asking, and I think this is relevant, do you run into problems of frequent hypokalemia by increasing the diuretic dose in the PD patients?
So we do occasionally see an increase in hypokalemia by increasing the diuretic dose. But most patients are delighted when I tell them they may increase their intake of citrus fruits, of bananas, potatoes, tomatoes, etc. And in the large majority of patients, the hypokalemia can be mitigated with dietary maneuvers and does not require potassium supplementation. Some of the patients, of course, do require K supplementation. As far as magnesium, most patients will remain normomagnesemic, especially if they're normokalemic. May, however, be utility to oral magnesium supplementation. Do pay attention to the potential action of the proton pump inhibitors. Remember that many of the PPIs, I think it's particularly omeprazole, but I believe it's a class effect, they interfere with the, I believe it's TRPM6, the transporter that is used to absorb magnesium from the GI tract. So if you have patients on a PPI, oral magnesium may not be efficacious. There is some literature on the use of intraperitoneal magnesium, but I have only once found it necessary to do that.
Great, thank you. This question is for Dr. Andrum. They're asking about those patients that seem to have pruritus that is triggered or worsened by dialysis. Have you encountered this kind of patients?
Yeah, no. I guess that can happen, that being on dialysis seems to exacerbate pruritus. I think it is hard to sort out what the causal mechanism would be. A lot of times, like a number of sensations, human beings tend to be aware of pain or restlessness or itching if they're kind of told not to do anything, and that's what happens during dialysis treatments. It's not uncommon that people effectively will have like a rake and be scratching themselves all the whole time. I think that the approach to those patients really isn't different than the approach to patients with uremic pruritus overall, in that you want to treat their skin with emollients and then kind of manage their symptoms as needed.
So is there any difference between giving the pregabalin in the morning versus doing it pre-dialysis? So I have some patients that take an extra dose of pregabalin before going into dialysis, and they seem to feel better in order to tolerate the long hemodialysis session. Do you have any experience on this?
So I don't. I mean, that's an interesting thought to folks that have, more symptoms associated with dialysis.
Yeah. So you already talked about ultrafiltration feedback to prevent intradialytic hypotension. And they're asking what is known about intradialytic hypotension in home dialysis patients, home hemo. Do you have any experience with this?
I think that's a very good and interesting question. And I do not really know of any data on this. Only data what we know is, I think, from the frequent hemodialysis network, but this was not where the major, I think the largest effect was observed in the nocturnal group. And I think in the FHN, looking correctly, the nocturnal group was also in center. Eh? I think you could easily translate this, I think, to the home situation. What I think is just that reducing the interdialytic, not only the interdialytic weight gain, but also increasing the dialysis treatment time, leading to a lowering of ultrafiltration rate, actually is of benefit. So any maneuver which you can think of lowering intradialytic, lowering the ultrafiltration rate would be by definition of interest and relevance for preventing intradialytic hypotension. And I think it would also hold true for home patients. So probably I think the nocturnal, if you have the chance to treat a patient at home, and patient can be treated with wants to be treated with a nocturnal schedule, I would really be in favor of that, and we also try to encourage our patients to do so.
Great, thank you. This is another question for Dr. Tolbaum. Why do you favor high doses of Lasix rather than using bumetanide or torsemide?
Any loop diuretic. I don't care. I have the most experience with furosemide, but bumetanide, obviously a 4-to-1 ratio, but a 40-to-1 ratio, excuse me, but any loop diuretic I think is fine.
Maybe I can support it. We use it also regularly, actually, in all of our patients to say the high doses. And when you have urinary volume above 300 mLs also in hemodialysis patients, and we actually do not see any hearing problems there. Yeah, we do not test for it routinely, but as ever, not been any complaints in our view. It's also a safe way to do.
So this is a question for Dr. Onron. There are studies show that p-crisol sulfate is associated with severity of pruritus, and another article suggesting using oral charcoal to manage pruritus. What is your opinion on this?
Charcoal is one of many agents that have been used. I think that, to me, what would be interesting is trying to understand the mechanism of that a little bit better. Like, what is it that the p-crisol is doing? I guess it's not one of the top agents I would use. So there is limited data about it, but it isn't necessarily something I would turn to first.
This is a question for Dr. Kuman. Any idea why patients with liver dysfunction chronically have low BP? Any measures to avoid intradialytic hypotension in these subjects?
Also a very good question. Patients with liver cirrhosis actually have by themselves an increase decrease in systemic vascular tone. And it has been assumed that it's due to, for instance, effects of nitric oxide, but the mechanism is not completely clear. So what I would do, and it's indeed a commonly observed phenomenon also in patients with liver disease, not on dialysis, I think I would mainly use the same interventions, reducing interdialytic weight gain, and also doing temperature controlled dialysis. I also do not know of any, let's say, data in this specific group of patients that pharmacological interventions might be of relevance in improving intradialytic hypotension per se, but maybe my colleagues can comment on that.
Peritoneal dialysis.
Absolutely. But you're absolutely true, and I think that's correct, because I think the outcome in patients with liver cirrhosis and peritoneal dialysis is actually quite acceptable in a way, and it's certainly not a contraindication, I think. Thank you for that.
So another question for Dr. Kuman. Does albumin help intradialytic hypotension, or as it contains sodium, it will end up with more sodium retaining and by their water retention?
We studied this some time ago, actually, and indeed in patients who experience intradialytic hypotension, the use of albumin could improve blood pressure temporarily, but obviously it's a very expensive treatment. It also can have some side effects. We do not use this on any routine basis. I can only think that we used it in a patient who had a very severe hypoalbuminemia once, that we because we could not really get his blood pressure into the right direction, we sometimes had to give a little bit of albumin during dialysis. But absolutely, we do not do this on a routine basis, although it can temporarily increase blood pressure. But there's no, let's say, literature which I know of that it's in this way superior to the infusion of intradialytic saline in patients who experience severe intradialytic hypotension.
Thank you. Mark?
Could I get to ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
I guess this is for Dr. Teitelbaum. It just seemed to me that the new PD guidelines sort of reflect the tension between patient-based care and having standards. And while individual standards may or may not be associated with quality of life or mortality outcomes or improvement of those, the sum of those seem to be helpful. Like Mike Rocco had a paper in the hemodialysis population demonstrating that, in units where you consistently hit the metrics, such as they were at the time, those patients tended to do better. I guess, is there a concern that by focusing more on the person and the patient, that you'll be sort of attenuating those sort of standard expectations?
I guess the dilemma for me is the fact that the so-called standards don't have the scientific rigor to back them up. And it's not clear to me that they should have ever become the standards. So I go back to doing complete, thorough, patient-focused assessment. And for my patients who tell me that they feel well, function well, are devoid of classic uremic symptoms, are able to enjoy life, participate in the activities that they value, I wish I didn't even have to check the KT over V. My nurses torture me because administrators torture them. And when I get a KT over V of 1.55 or something like that, and the nurse comes to me and says, you need to adjust the prescription, and I go back and talk to the patient and review my notes and so on, and I say, no, I'm not going to. And they go, but they're going to come and yell at us, and when we put this into Crown Web, we're going, and I say, fine, send them to me, let me deal with it. And so far they haven't tortured me, but that day may come. I'm hoping that we can backtrack from this dependence. But I guess to come back to your point, sure, there is a possibility that by relaxing these standards, for lack of a better word, someone may say, okay, I don't need to provide as much dialysis, and somewhere some patient may suffer, but not if a clinician does his or her job correctly.
So to piggyback onto that, do you have any thoughts on what we could use as a new standard, what we could put into Crown Web to document that we're attending to our patients?
So I love numbers as much as the next guy, even more than most. But not everything lends itself to be readily quantified. And I think quality of life, absence of symptoms more than anything else. Can I come up with a score, with a number? Not yet.
How about residual kidney function? Do you have any, what would be any recommendations to preserve residual kidney function in PD patients? Do you use ACE, ARBs?
So there is good evidence that using an ACE or an ARB can help preserve residual kidney function. There is the suggestion that judicious use of radio contrast media, although when you, let me put it this way. For my own practice, I'm going to approach the patient on PD who needs a contrast procedure the same way as I'm going to approach the patient who has a GFR of 16 and I'm trying to stave off the need for dialysis. Do they absolutely need the procedure? Can we minimize the volume of contrast used, keep the patient well hydrated? Judicious use of non-steroidals, judicious use of aminoglycosides, etc.
Thank you. So for Dr. Kuman, sodium profiling has increased mortality risk. What do you think of the effect of isotonic dialysis?
I think isotonic dialysis is really a very interesting potential novel approach. There's quite some, and at this moment there's actually quite some discussion on the literature on the optimal dialysate sodium levels. There have even been some kind of controversial results that in some patients actually the higher dialysate sodium, although being associated with an increased interdialytic weight gain, were not necessarily associated with an increased mortality risk. But there's actually quite some, interesting discussion about this in literature which has not finished yet. And I think to come back to the question that from a theoretical point of view, I think isonatremic dialysis in which you prevent the loading of sodium from the dialysate to the patient, which really can occur if you have a patient who is hyponatremic and being treated with a standard dialysate concentration of even 138, to prevent this. But I think novel studies are really to have to be developed to see their clinical benefits. The only study which I know of it so far are the studies from De Paula from Brazil some time ago, where it actually isonatremic dialysis improved interdialytic weight gain and blood pressure control. But these were relatively small studies. So that should be, this should be the focus for future studies.
There's an ongoing trial, right, looking at that.
Oh, could I ask a follow-up question? I mean, it was really fascinating to go back into the literature and, you know, to look at the hemodynamic data that you presented. For me, most of that seemed to be in chronic hemo. And I was wondering kind of what lessons I can learn from your talk that, and the extent to which what you spoke about apply to the setting of acute kidney injury, dialyzing someone on 3 pressors, right?
Yeah, I think actually there are not so many data on that, but I think looking at pathophysiology, I think it would also hold true for patients, even more true for patients who have acute kidney disease and can be hemodynamically compromised in a way. So I would actually go with the same maneuvers actually as I would do in the patients who are on chronic hemo. In our unit, actually, we usually in the ICU use continuous techniques and move on to intermittent techniques if the patient is off vasopressors and is more hemodynamically stable. But that's our own approach. Yeah.
So there's another comment here saying that C. Jason Dobbs' paper showed programs that aim to avoid hypotension do well. Those that use relative blood volume monitoring do poorly. Why not stop using these monitors and get rid of them and save some money?
That's a challenging question. I think it's correct in a way that it has certainly not been shown to improve outcomes yet. It could also be that we maybe have been looking at the wrong parameter actually for blood volume monitoring. And in this way, I think still that the observations of RRI are of importance. Looking maybe at a kind of a golden zone where mortality risk is lowest. But on the other hand, of course, you have patients. It can be very much patient-dependent in which patients can tolerate. And maybe some of the patients cannot tolerate the golden zone observed for the best mortality. What I would take maybe properly from the relative blood volume so far is actually the identification of flat curves, because they can be seen as a kind of a risk factor for adverse outcomes in dialysis patients. So, In this way, I would use it mainly for identification of patients at risk. But I can also, I remember also, we do not use it routinely in our unit, that we had a young patient who had with a stoma and who had experienced let's say, enormous unexplained intradiabetic hypertensive episodes. And when we did look at relative blood volume in this patient, we saw that it really went down very quickly to 15-20%. So I think it's more actually to use it if you have the availability as a kind of a signal. But in this way, I think it's too early to really use it as a standard, as a threshold for which you should aim for, let's say, one absolute relative blood volume. But maybe, yeah, it can come back based on future studies with new algorithms, and it can still shown to be of relevance. Future will tell.
Thanks. Another question for Mark. What do you think is the effect of sodium thiosulfate in uremic pruritus and RLS?
I'm not sure, actually. I mean, to me, what seemed to be the most compelling pathophysiologic models would be sort of the inflammation in the skin, as well as the sort of changes in opioid receptor. And, you know, I guess it'd take a lot of hand-waving to argue that the sodium thiosulfate would change the distribution of opioid receptors. I suppose, you know, theoretically you could imagine that there may be some decrement in the inflammation of the skin, and maybe that's why you're seeing also benefits with calciphylaxis. But it would be a thought, and I mean, one thing that's nice about it, together with the new the CR845, is that it could be given on dialysis, whereas the, you know, some of the agents that are taken PO, you see sort of decrements with adherence over time.
Thank you. So, question for Dr. Kuman. What percent of your patients are on cool dialysis, and are they also on midodrine before dialysis?
We do not routinely use midodrine in our patients. Actually, I must admit, I've never used it. It's not so common to do this in the Netherlands. What we do is actually, when we start patients on dialysis, we have a standard temperature of 36.5 degrees centigrade. And actually, we lower this till a minimum of 35.5 if a patient has intradialytic hypotension or does not tolerate well. We do not go below this 35.5 degrees centigrade. And ideally would be to use, let's say, we also have a biofeedback tool on some of the modules, the BTM. But let's say our nurses do not use this routinely because you always have a kind of a discrepancy between optimal theoretical practice and what you can achieve in a busy dialysis unit with nurses who want just have clarity and say 35.5 is okay. And so we chose for the practical approach.
Great. Thank you. I don't know how much more time do we have. Oh, there's a question from the audience over there.
I'm the odd one out. I'm Dr. Nag from India. And I agree. We treat both PD patients and HD patients. We see more uremic pruritus in, this question is to Mark, in the PD patients and RLS in hemodialysis patients. But the patients respond beautifully to gabapentin. Can't go beyond 100 but because they become extremely drowsy. But those who don't respond, we have I don't know whether you're allowed to use that in the United States, but they respond very well to thalidomide. Have you tried that?
No, I haven't tried that. For me, the fact that you see response with the gabapentinoids, really it's not, that would be kind of what I'd expect. The change, when you look at the data, the change in itch severity is pretty dramatic with the gabapentinoids. It's just the side effect profile. So it would be nice to have another agent to go to, whether it's thalidomide or one of the newer agents.
I mean, not newer, older agent. Yeah. Thalidomide has been there for 50 years, 60 years, yes. Thank you.
Is there any other question from the audience? Hold on, let me see if there's... We have 3 more minutes, so let's see if... Okay, so there's more. They keep on coming. So... This is, I suppose, for Dr. Kuman. Do you use lung ultrasound to assess patient's volume status for adjustment in dry weight and volume overload?
Very good question. It's what we use routinely to assess volume status in all of our patients is bioimpedance. We use this as, let's say, a marker, not necessarily as a target, but also to identify patients which are potentially at risk and which we miss by our clinical examination. So that's what we do routinely on a monthly basis. Lung ultrasounds, I like doing it. I like doing ultrasounds myself. It's not that every dialysis clinician in our unit can do it. So what I do now with interested fellows is actually looking at patients especially who are acutely dyspneic or who have actually more to also to get experience in this. I think it's powerful. It can be a powerful tool. It can be relevant to use, and it's also been associated with mortality, and it's not that complicated. So I think you could make a case for using lung ultrasounds. The only thing is that we found, for instance, to implement bioimpedance in our unit is much easier because you can do it on a routine basis, make arrangements with the nurses to do so, and actually look at the data, let's say, every monthly to see if there are changes in the patient. So this is why we chose for you doing bioimpedance, but it does not mean that lung ultrasound is not a value or cannot be, let's say, especially relevant in patients who are more acutely ill. That's the way we do it now.
Agree. So, final question, again for Dr. Kuman. So, several patients with intradialytic hypotension have hypertension and take daily blood pressure meds. The common recommendation is to hold BP meds prior to dialysis on dialysis days. What is your approach? Does it make a difference? And, I mean, just adding my 2 cents, you know, we try not to use BP medications on any of the dialysis patients, try to, you know, target dry weight and control their blood pressure. But there are still some patients that do require the medication. So what is your approach on this?
I would not withhold them, also not beta blockers, if they need them for another reason. There's even some data that dialyzable beta blockers actually are associated with somewhat higher mortality. So this withdrawal of beta blockers, I would not do that. I would preferably actually continue beta blockers in a low dose if they need it for cardiac reasons. And what we usually use antihypertensive drugs is to take long-acting hypertensive drugs and sometimes to use them then in the evening if, let's say, some period after the dialysis has passed. But we do not routinely stop blood pressure drugs on a dialysis day because we know that on a dialysis day before dialysis, the blood pressure is even the highest. And that we're still actually concerned, although I know the data on, let's say, the short-term mortality risk with lower dialysis, lower systolic blood pressure. It could also be a marker of comorbidity, and probably I think the data, for instance, for Rajiv Agarwal have shown that, let's say, high blood pressures can also be at risk more in long term, as also Dr. Teitelbaum showed in his presentation. So I think blood pressure is still hypertension. If you cannot control it by volume control, needs to be treated, but preferably, in my opinion, by long-acting agents and not stopping them on a temporary basis because it's also for the patient a little bit difficult in a way to.
Great.
To do this.
So we need to conclude. Thank you so much for your brilliant presentations and for the discussion.
Thank you.